Hello and welcome to The Laydown. My name is Ryan and I'm so delighted that our first episode of 2023, kicking off our fifth season, is my interview with Grady Hendrix for his incredible new horror novel, How to Sell a Haunted House. I want to preface this by saying that I do not often reread books because as a bookseller, I simply have too much to read. So with that in mind, let me tell you that I have read How to Sell a Haunted House twice already, with plans to read it at least twice more this year. It may only be January, but this is already shaping up to be my favorite book of the year. So have you ever wished the Chucky movies were scarier? Do you love reading about family trauma and family drama? Are you a fan of haunted dolls? Are you freaked out by puppets? Wow, 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 do I have a book for you. I don't want to give too much away, but I will say this. Pupkin is one of the most unsettling characters I've had the pleasure of reading, and Grady Hendrix got a full body reaction out of me with one word in this book. Like Horror Store, this is a book that is so much scarier than you think it's going to be. But it also tackles some really nuanced issues like grief and familial relationships and guilt. This book made me scream and cry, and I haven't been able to stop thinking about it since the first time I read it. It's terrifying, it's beautiful, it's powerful, it's so deeply disturbing. I loved every second of it. Grady Hendrix has absolutely outdone himself with this one. I love How to Sell a Haunted House, and I can't wait for you all to read it, and I can't wait for you all to listen to my interview. So without further ado, here's my chat with Grady Hendrix. Hi, Grady Hendrix. How are you?
I'm okay. What's going on in New Hampshire? Are y'all snowed in?
We have been, yeah. I was absolutely snowed in yesterday and the whole weekend. I had like 2 feet of snow just surrounding my house.
See, I'm from South Carolina originally, so like snow sounds so exotic. we get a quarter inch of hard frost and everyone loses their minds down here. And snow, winter horror is always the best.
Yes. That is true. Winter horror is pretty spectacular.
The Thing, The Shining. You've got all the like abominable snowman books like, The Spirit and The Beast. Like, yeah, I'm in.
Yeah. So I live on a mountain, basically. And we've talked about this before. I maybe bought my house from a cult. I'm pretty isolated up in the woods of New Hampshire. So while the snow is beautiful, it is also terrifying.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's amazing. I think we've mentioned this before. I think the cults are a lot more common than people think. Like, I've got several friends who grew up in cults, and it's really, you know, are they that scary? Yes, they are.
If you get on their wrong side, yes.
Exactly. Well, I mean, you watch something like The Wicker Man. I mean, that cult, it's one person once a year. Is that really? Smoking kills more people than that.
That's true. Okay, so How to Sell a Haunted House. I have to preface this by saying...
Was that a question?
How to sell a haunted house? No. How do you sell a haunted house?
It's difficult.
It is tough in this market. Although it wouldn't be a deal breaker for me. but so, you know, I'm a bookseller. In my line of work, I don't really get to reread books. So when I tell you I'm currently reading this for the third time.
Oh, my God. You're a glutton for punishment.
Yeah. Congrats on writing my favorite book of the year already.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it. You know, I got to say, it's funny. This book was really hard to land. Like, we had to bump the pub date 6 months because it was not coming through. And before, when we were done with it, my editor and I were like, you know what? We're happy with where this wound up, but we'll do better next time. Like, you know what I mean? This will be one for a few people and they'll really like it. And you know, they can't all work, you know, sometimes and so it's been bizarre and really gratifying, but really astounding that people are connecting with this book, because we both thought it was too weird and too personal and too personal for people to really go for it. But I guess the lesson is I need to be more personal next time.
Well, and I think that's like, that's such a good like aspect of it, is that like you do have this like terrifying horror story and you know, one of my favorite terrifying characters of all time in Pupkin, but then you also have this like really emotional story of grief and family and like the arc of Mark and Louise as siblings, and it's so, I don't know, it like this is the only book I've ever read where I both screamed and cried. Mm-hmm. Well, and I love that.
I appreciate that. Well, it's funny, you know, it's I feel like I wrote this during the pandemic to sort of like, I missed my family. So I wanted to write a book about with a family in it where I could kind of hang out with an imaginary family. And it really was a time when sort of my parents both live are still alive, as far as I know. I mean, I haven't seen either of them in a few hours, but where like the pandemic really made me super aware of their mortality and just how vulnerable they were at their age. And so I feel like this, and then I think everyone has those stuffed animals we grow up with that, and our relationship with them when we leave them behind is a little fraught. I feel like Toy Story lets Andy off a little too easy.
Yeah.
Oh, we're happy for you to leave us back. Really? Are you? And so I feel like that stuff was really on my mind, and maybe it was on other people's, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like I connected with so many parts of this book, because even though like my parents are still alive, and I don't have any siblings, but I have a 5-year-old daughter who, by the way, I came home the other day and she had a sock puppet on and was like,
"Oh my God,
Mr. Sock Puppet." I was like, "Oh."
That it felt fire. Kill it with fire.
Kill it with fire. She like made it a whole thing. I was like, nope, I'm so sorry. You can't have this. No.
Did it have a name?
It was Mr. Sock Puppet.
Oh, okay. That's pretty
so
good.
So like not as terrifying as Pupkin.
Yeah. It's not like New Mommy or something.
Right. Oh God, I know.
I'm New Mommy.
Yeah, no. She is a creepy child at times, but she kind of leads into it. Like she knows how to be creepy. So I just take it with a grain of salt. I'm like, you're doing this on purpose.
I imagine you saying that to her when she's like levitating 3 inches off the ground. You're doing this on purpose. No one's going to pay attention to you right now.
Yeah, 100%. She's just like, it's like, oh, it's just for the attention. Stop it.
Yeah.
this book to me, I was able to connect. Like the characters in this book, I love so dearly, right? Like obviously Mark and Louise, but also like the aunts and the cousins.
Aunt Honey, yeah.
And like, oh, I love them so much. And like, even like a gutter, like I love him.
He just wants to make a living, man. He's got that dead tooth. Well, you know, and the cousins and the aunt, it's funny. It's like, one of my sisters-in-law was years ago after reading My Best Friend's Exorcism was saying, they're all only children. And she really called me out on it. And I was like, yeah, because families are hard. But the fact is, I'm surrounded by family. When I come home, it's like, you know, it's like, oh, so-and-so is, you know, you need this person to say, oh, well, your cousin is a mechanic, or, you know, oh, your cousin, you can borrow that. It's just, they surround you and they're sort of the atmosphere you live in. So I sort of wanted to capture that a little bit.
Yeah, no, it's great. It absolutely feels like I know every one of these characters so well. And, you know, it's funny. So reading this over and over as I've been doing for reasons I can't get enough of it. Like the first time I read this book, the beginning, the first time you meet Mark, I was so frustrated with him. I was like, oh, he's so obnoxious and like he just doesn't get it. And what a pain. And now every time I read it, I have more and more sympathy for him. And I'm like, he's just doing his best.
Exactly. Well, that's the thing, right? Like, all of us have siblings and we're like, you've been around them since you were a kid. And you're like, I know all your tricks. I know your BS. This is that sad story you tell about how mom and dad didn't pick you up that time when you were, you know, took ski lessons and you stood in the snow, boo hoo. But then when you hear their point of view, you're like, oh, that's not the story I remember it as, you know? And so they wanted to do that with Mark, you know, where he seems like who you feel like you've got his number right from the beginning. And then you're like, oh no, even jerks have their own point of view.
Yeah. Yeah. And what a time he had. Yeah. So I want to talk about Pupkin because, oh my God, Pupkin. I, you know, dolls are creepy, puppets can be creepy, but I didn't realize how creepy puppets could be until I read Pupkin. You have a history with puppets, yes?
Yeah, I was in a radical puppet collective.
Incredible.
Yeah, and not for very long, only for a few months. But yeah, we were super active. We were out of Boston. And a lot of those shows in the book are ones based on ones we did. We did a show at an elementary school. It was about Pinochet and the disappeared. But, you know, in Chile, but it was, you know, we thought the kids could use it. We did political puppetry and we didn't see any reason to change what we did. But it was a blast. They were really great, super talented. And like the puppets we built were incredible. But yeah, so yeah, I've done puppetry and mask work a ton back in university and high school.
That is amazing. So when you write the description of like the way it feels wearing Pupkin, did that ring true for you? Like, did
Oh
you
yeah.
feel like the puppet took over?
Yeah, and it's not so much a case of like it's not as spooky as it sounds. I mean, you can do this, like put a sock puppet on and start talking to it. And after 15 minutes or so, you're gonna have a hard time realizing it's part of you. Like, where's that willpower coming from? It's not consciously coming from you. It's a really amazing trick our brains do. But definitely puppets and the puppets we did in this collective were big ones that you wore. And we did small ones, but mostly big ones you wore. So it was like masks. And you know, they tell you how you're supposed to act when you put them on. They really have their own personalities. It's been that way to all the way back to the dawn of time. There are some cultures where, you know, they use masks as part of being in a possession state. And it really works. And it's just a psychological effect, but if you lean into it, it's really powerful. You know, it removes you, it gives you this great freedom to do anything because it's not you. You've got this protective force field of this mask or this puppet. You know, and also at the same time, it really you respond to all these cues you see embedded in it as to how it wants to act and how it should act. And you know, one of the things I think is so amazing in the book, they mention this as sort of a negative. I think it's such a positive is if you've ever seen the Sesame Street or the Muppet Show set, you know, you're seeing it from mid-level up, but right there on the soundstage floor, there is an adult man with a monitor he's watching with a puppet on his arm and the kid or whoever's interacting up here. But there's an adult male or woman crouched at a kid's feet. And it is very disruptive and very obvious and is not subtle. They're wearing their street clothes usually. And it is astounding. You will never see the child interact with that person. They will always interact with the puppet. And there's
That's
something
fascinating.
so powerful about that. And you know, and as much as people say dolls are creepy, one of the things I find so really moving in a way is almost every child, I would say every child, but I'm going to leave some exceptions for weirdos. You give them a stuffed animal and confronted with something smaller and weaker and more defenseless than them. The kid immediately becomes concerned with taking care of it, making sure it's happy, making sure it's comfortable, making sure it's safe, explaining things to it, you know? And I think that's so moving that the first instinct is to comfort and take care of this smaller, weaker creature.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And yeah, again, I've seen that happen with both of my kids. Their initial stuffies are like they're everything.
Oh yeah. Well, and Pupkin is based on my wife's first stuffed animal, Snokio, who lives with us to this day. And he's a great guy. I will confess, when I met him for the first time, it was did trigger my fight or flight reflex. But he, you know, he looks the way he looks and he acts the way he acts, and that's just him.
I love that. Kind of thinking along those lines, it kind of reminds me of like when authors, and I've experienced this too, when you're writing something and like your characters will do something and you're like, oh, I guess we're doing this now. All right.
Right.
Like I wasn't planning on that. And I imagine that probably happens for you. I'm curious, have your characters ever scared you while writing? Have they?
No.
No?
No, and it's funny when people talk about the characters take over, it's they do in a way. I mean, you make up these imaginary playmates and you invest a lot of time in them. So they do kind of take on a life of their own. But they never like surprise me, you know? So I've never had them really scare me or do anything like that. But you know, I will say though, it so writing books is weird because you basically spend a year with imaginary playmates and thinking about a place that doesn't exist, and you invest a lot of emotional energy in it. And so I wrote this book called We Sold Our Souls, about a heavy metal musician named Chris. And it's later in life, her band's gone. The lead singer of the band went off and became famous on his own, but their band never made it. And she's pissed off about it and really sort of at a low point. And she has this sort of like never quit attitude. And she just won't give up, which I don't think is the best quality. And that was a book that really I was going through a lot of stuff when I wrote it. I wanted to do a book that felt very contemporary, and I felt like, you know, no one's really exploiting the horror of conspiracy theories and this sort of idea that like the world's controlled by all these forces. And you know, and so this was during 2016 was when I started it. And so it was very much, you know, astroturfing and Pizzagate and all these things. And it was really dark. And I was really immersed in this conspiracy world, just kind of like trying to stay in that mindset. And the book was so dark. And my editor wouldn't accept the manuscript. And I kept rewriting it and rewriting it. And he's just like, dude, it's just not working. And finally, I remember it was December 22nd. And also the other thing is, because he wasn't accepting the manuscript, I wasn't getting the back half of my advance. And that I racked up, I got us into a lot of debt. I was using a credit card to pay our bills and stuff. And I didn't tell my wife, and it was not good. And so on December 22nd, he was like, we were on the phone for a really long time. And he's like, the book's got to come off the schedule. He's like, we'll do better next time. But this book just isn't working. It's too dark. It's too. And he was right. And he was really right. But the problem was like, I had to pay back the advance, which I didn't have, and I had a mountain of debt. And so I went away, and it was Christmas. And Chris, the character, has that sort of like, it was this weird thing of like, it's almost like leaving a stuffed animal behind when you're a kid. I just invested her with so much time and so much energy that I felt beholden to her. And I was like, I can't do this. I can't just abandon her. I was like, she's would never do this to me, even though she's not real. But like, I was just like, she'd never do this to me. Like, I can't do this. And it wasn't some like amazing moment. It was just like, I was emotionally incapable of doing that. I couldn't have done it. And so I took about 7 days when I knew their office would be closed from like January 1st to 7th. It was that first weekend and weekend. And I rewrote the book and I just was merciless and tore stuff out. And my editor was like, when I gave it to him, he's like, oh, okay, I'll take another read. And he was like, okay, this we can work with. And we got it to where it needed to be. But so that was really, it wasn't a case of my character coming to life and surprising me. It was a case of where I had this emotional relationship with the character where I couldn't walk away. And yes, there was debt. There was all this stuff attached to it, but it was really primarily for me, it was like, I couldn't have like taken my childhood curious George, who I loved, and just like thrown him out a moving car window. You know what I mean? Like, I couldn't have done that to him, and I couldn't have done that to her. So they do take on a life in that respect.
Oh, I love that.
Sorry, it was a ridiculously long answer for a relatively simple question.
No,
Sorry.
that please. I literally could talk about this book and all of your books all day forever. So please. I just have, you should see my like unhinged notes from
Bring it, man. The more unhinged, the
time
better. You should see my unhinged book.
this. Yeah. I know you posted a photo of your like wall of
Oh, the
like
wall of crazy.
inspiration.
Yeah.
I loved that.
Well, it's funny. There's a picture on there because sometimes I'll put something up and it just won't work for a book, and it'll just sound like, I don't know. And there's a picture on there of a little girl wearing an old man mask, like a rubber mask, walking up a flight of stairs. And I think I put that on there around We Sold Our Souls in 2016. And it just didn't play a part in that book. It didn't play a part in the next book. It didn't play a part in the next book. And then for this one, that was really one of those sort of like primary images for it. So it's like stuff just hangs around until it becomes apparent why you cut it out.
Yeah. You're like, this resonated for some reason. I'll find out why.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah. The imagery in this book, there are scenes seared into my brain. I mean, Spider, the imaginary six-legged blue dog.
If he's going to be imaginary, he doesn't have to look
so
like
crazy.
A real dog. Yeah, exactly.
Right? I love it.
Well, you know, it's funny. Spider was fun because I feel like kids' version of the world is much different. And there's two places. There's a great, this comic book writer, Alan Moore, had a series in the 80s called Swamp Thing. It was like his horror series. But there's a throwaway panel in it because there's a monster that makes nightmares come to life. And there's a kid in a home for a children's home who is scared of cancer because their father died of cancer. But no one ever took the time to explain what cancer is. And so they imagine cancer as this giant, just dripping, horrible monster. And that always stuck with me. And then there was a guy named Arthur Tress, who was a photographer in the 70s. And you might have seen these already. He did a series of photo shoots where he asked kids what their nightmares were. And then he staged the nightmares with the kids as the subject. So like kids who had a nightmare about like being buried alive, or kids who had a nightmare about being turned into wood, or all this wild stuff. And it's just so, the images are so potent and alive, but they're so weird and surreal and dark. They're really amazing.
That's incredible. Yeah, and kids, their nightmares are so vivid. I still can picture my childhood, like, recurring nightmares and just...
Yeah, and it's funny. I find, like YA comes in all flavors. So it's hard to say YA because it's not really a genre. But I find that before Harry Potter, around 95, 97, in there, it didn't have the cachet it does now.
Right.
And so editors were a little looser, like there wasn't such focus on it. And so writers got away with some really nightmarish stuff. William Sleater wrote a book called Among the Dolls. He wrote House of Stairs, a bunch of children's books in the 70s and 80s. But Life Among the Dolls is horrifying. And there's another book Carol Beach York wrote called Revenge of the Dolls. And these are both books like 103, 140 pages that they're so adult. There's this real terror of these dolls, but a real sense that like childhood ends. You know, these dolls come to life and there's a price to be paid, and they're really amazing books. And there's a woman, Kayla Janice, has a podcast she's been working on called A Song from the Heart. And it's based on a project she had about the evolution of children's entertainment. And for her, there were all these pioneers, Jim Henson, all these other people who came out of sort of the hippie 50s and 60s, you know, and they were like, kids go out and have adventures, kids get in trouble and all these things. And for her, there was a moment around 81 where the first milk carton kid appeared, and this feeling became that your kids are in danger. People want to get at your children. And that's sort of this moment where she realized children's entertainment started to be much more about the world scary. You need to stay safe. You need to stranger danger and all that, which isn't to say people won't abduct kids, but it got a little overblown. And a lot of these people, Jim Henson's obviously an exception, but a lot of these children's entertainment pioneers really fell out of favor because their message of go anywhere, do anything, fall down, get cuts and bruises, talk to people became really anathema in the 80s, which was like, be safe. Strangers are dangers, like that kind of thing. So it's really fascinating to see that arc. And when you look back at this earlier pre-Harry Potter children's fiction, it's all slightly more dangerous, I think. And there's nothing, listen, I love, there's YA books. Daniel Krause's Rotters is like one of the most punk rock antisocial books I've ever read. And it's YA, but there is a definite sea change that happened. So yeah. So anyways, this is a long way of getting back to Spider and saying like, you know, a kid imagining a dog who says it has to have four legs and walks on the ground.
Yeah. And in fact, when he's walking on the ceiling, that is much more.
Yeah. Exactly.
I love, and this kind of ties back into what we were talking about kind of at the beginning and the emotions of this book, but I love flipping through this. I love that the book is broken up into the five stages of grief and that the story follows that. I read the advanced reader copy ahead of the NEBA conference in October. And then the next two times I've listened to the audiobook, which is so good. And so I had forgotten that it does that, like the big black page with like anger.
Right.
And I was flipping through and I was like, oh, right. That's so effective.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Oh, it's funny. The anger one came first. And then I was like, because I really feel like the job is to get people turning to the next page. Yeah. And so anything I can use to structure that, like, you know, it's, it helps. And so being able to link it to the stages of grief, for we all know there's five of them, you know, it was just a nice way to also help pull readers through the book.
Yeah.
And they work, they're real.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Whoever came up with those, they're onto something.
You're spot on. Yeah. I mean, I literally, the first time I read this, I sat down and read it in one sitting. I was like, no one talk to me. I like knew Grady Hendrix just dropped.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And it's funny. To me, the fact that the book pulled you in that much is huge, but it's also, there's always this tiny part of me that's like, but it took me a year to write.
But now I'm reading it for the third time.
That's true.
I can't get enough. And we are currently sold out of it because I keep chucking it at people and being like, no, you need this.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Absolutely.
But it's also, you know, it's funny too, like, I always want to be a faster writer, but and I write relatively fast, but also one of the things I've learned is that it's kind of like people make fun of actors for being like, you know, well, what's this character's favorite ice cream? What's his relationship with his mother like? But I'm like, there's so much in the books I love that you realize is off the page.
Yeah.
Like if you're reading The Secret History, you know, or something like that, like there's so much about those characters that never makes it onto the page. And that's what makes it rereadable, you know? So it's like, that's a lot of work. I wish there was an easier process here.
I know. I like, wouldn't it be nice if you could just like take it and like, tap.
Exactly.
But
also part of it is like, you know, the time it takes, you just think about the thing over and over and over again, or you'll go crazy. And so it's the time it takes is part of what makes it work, because you have to spend so much time working on it. I don't know if that makes sense, but like sofa cushions. If you had to think about sofa cushions for a year, you'd have some deep thoughts on sofa cushions. There's some complicated thoughts on sofa cushions.
Absolutely. Yeah. No. Truly incredible. Again, I know we have to wrap up because you have a busy schedule. Like
sure,
I said, I could literally talk about this book all day.
I really appreciate that.
And I will never stop throwing it at my customers because, oh my God.
That's something I'm really grateful for, because honestly, in books, there's no magic bullet, man. Books are all about word of mouth. That really is the only way they move.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I am back in October, so we have a display for pre-orders. And so my coworkers and I will laminate these little sheets with the book cover and a barcode and like a brief description on the back. And so I put up the second a cover dropped for this, we made a pre-order card, and I would just like, I would listen to people in the horror section, and as soon as they mentioned like certain keywords, I would just run up with the thing and I'd be like, you need to pre-order this. So I think I wrote my staff pick review last October for this book that came out last week.
Thank you. I could not be more grateful.
Oh, it's incredible. Okay. As we wrap up, what are you working on next? What's next for you?
So the next book is going to be out next year, or maybe in January 2025. I'm hoping next year. It's a sort of Rosemary's Baby set in a home for unwed mothers in 1970. Just because I find that homes from my mother's, they were everywhere. And they're a real blind spot culturally. And I started writing this book and working on it before the Dobbs decision. And so all of a sudden, it's like the world is suddenly talking about this again. So I guess I'm lucky, but it's weird because this one is a lot of research before I started writing, because I am a childless middle-aged man writing about a house full of pregnant women. And I've got a lot of pregnant women I've interviewed about their birth stories, a lot of OBs, a lot of labor and delivery nurses and physicians, like just a lot. And then it's got to be 1970s specific, which is I've got my Williams obstetrics manual and paging through. And I used to be so squeamish about childbirth and hearing about it. And now I'm like, tell me about your C-section, you know, like let's talk episiotomies, like let's go. Because it is weird. It is like, the thing that got me on this book was like, these girls, and they really were girls. I mean, they were 13 years old, 14 years old, 15 years old. And yes, those are young women, but I like to use girls just to, I don't want people to forget that these were kids who couldn't even legally drive, being sent away from home and being treated like criminals for doing what really is the most natural thing out there, having sex and having a baby. I mean, that's pretty much, if anything's hardwired into us, it's that. And so it's just so wild. And, you know, that was the beginning of sort of the occult boom, the early 70s. And so it's been fun.
Oh, I can't wait for that. Again, as someone with two kids, I'm like, yes, bring it on.
We'll see. You'll have to let me know if I get something wrong, because I'm trying to be super cautious on this one in terms of like getting it vetted, because I just do not, it would be so easy for me to screw this up.
Yeah. Well, man, there is something incredibly horrific about childbirth. There are many horrific things about childbirth.
It was, but I mean, I don't know. Was it all also, horrific or was it amazing? I don't know.
It's both. I often say that while I greatly respect people who can do home births and natural births and things like that, with both of mine, I would have died. So
right.
Thanks, but modern medicine.
But let me ask you a question. Like, what was the biggest thing you remember from being pregnant? Like, just like the overriding.
It was just the uncomfortable like heaviness, and with both of my kids, they would pick one spot and just push as hard as they could. And so like I was constantly just like pushing back and being like, oh, this is so weird, and there's an alien in me. And
that's wild. That must be such a crazy feeling.
It is so weird. It is so weird. And it is heavy. Like I would like hold my stomach from underneath, because it's like otherwise I'm just like, ow, everything. It's wild.
Well, I mean, there must be that moment as like week 40 approaches where you're just like, there's an animal in me that wants out.
And particularly with my second kid, like you could see her, like she would like move around and you'd be like, that's her hand. That's her foot.
Wow.
That's her butt.
Oh, like, you wouldn't even have to feel it. You could actually
see. Because she would press again. Like it was straight out of a horror movie. Like she was terrifying.
That's cool, man.
It was, but now, you know, now they're out and they're great and they're healthy and it's all good.
Your internal organs are walking around and having opinions.
It is, yes. And some of those opinions are so spooky. incredible. Grady, it is always an absolute delight to chat with you. I love your books. I love this book. Congratulations. I'm so excited for what comes next. I like almost don't want to wrap up, but I know that I should.
It's good to see you again. It's nice to have been doing this for long enough that we've done this more than once. You know, we're gonna have to do this in person at some point. Have we
absolutely
ever done this in person?
We have not. We did the NEBA conference. I got to introduce you, but we've never. Anytime. You're welcome. Anytime.
You're not that far from New York.
No, we're not.
Are y'all the Don't Tread on Me state? What is New Hampshire?
We're Live Free or Die. So.
Oh, Live Free or Die.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The heavy metal state, clearly.
Heavy metal state. Yes, we're very cool. Incredible. Well, thank you so much.
Oh, yeah.
I can't wait for everyone to read this book. And good luck with the rest of your tour and promotion, and good luck writing your next one.
Thank you. I need it. And thank you so much for advocating for this book, because I honestly, it's only connecting with people because booksellers are actually doing what you do. So thank you.
You're so welcome. Have a great day.
Bye. You too.
Bye. Huge thanks again to Grady Hendrix for joining me on the podcast and being my first guest of 2023. How to Sell a Haunted House is available now from Gibson's Bookstore. You can email us about the podcast at thelaydownpodcast@gmail.com. Our website is gibsonsbookstore.com, and we're also on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, and we'll put those links in the show notes. Thank you all so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll know when we upload our next episode, and consider leaving us a nice review. Until next time, we'll see you in the bookstore.